I'm Shelley Palmer with today's top stories in technology, media, and entertainment. First up, President Obama has named the first Chief Technology Officer of the United States of America. His name is Anish Chopra. Although many people in technology and related fields were hoping that the job of U.S. CTO would be a cabinet-level position, this can only be viewed as a fantastic first step in the right direction.
An enthusiastic rap there for Barack Obama's choice of National Chief Technology Officer, or CTO. Well, in a moment, we'll get a more balanced view from Mika Sifri, the co-founder and editor of the influential website The Personal Democracy Forum. Anthony Fennell here. Hello and welcome to Future Tense on ABC Radio National. And also today, the Internet of Things. Even its proponents find it hard to define. But shortly, we'll get details from two people who believe its development isn't just inevitable, it's already underway. First, though, to US President Obama and his weekly internet address to Americans about the new CTO role and how it will fit in with his overall administration's approach.
Anish Chopra, who's currently the Secretary of Technology for Governor Tim Kaine in Virginia, has agreed to serve as America's Chief Technology Officer. In this role, Anish will promote technological innovation to help achieve our most urgent priorities, from creating jobs and reducing healthcare costs to keeping our nation secure. Anish Chopra will work closely with our Chief Information Officer, Vivek Kundra, who is responsible for setting technology policy across the government and using technology to improve security, ensure transparency, and lower costs. The goal is to give all Americans a voice in their government and ensure that they know exactly how we're spending their money and can hold us accountable for the results.
Now, if you remember, we mentioned the CTO position back on our first program in the context of Obama's campaign promises regarding what's called e-democracy and e-government. And it's taken until now for the appointment to be made. Back then, one of the people we spoke to about the CTO role was Mika Sifri. So let's get an update. Mika Sifri, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be here.
Tell us about Anish Chopra and his background. I mean, how suitable is he for this particular role?
Well, Anish is the currently the Secretary of Technology for the state of Virginia, where he has scored very high marks from his peers. In fact, I think he was voted the number one state CTO in a recent survey. And his job there has been to drive innovation across the state bureaucracy in a variety of ways. I think he's had a particular interest in healthcare technology, but of larger interest to me and maybe also to your listeners, he's shown some real promise, both in understanding how people can be engaged in a new way by government, opening up conversations and taking input from the public by using the web. And he has also shown a almost Silicon Valley-style approach to supporting innovation using technology inside the bureaucracy. Somebody actually referred to him as a venture governmentalist instead of a venture capitalist in that he was willing to provide funding for innovative projects in various agencies in Virginia that all won't succeed. And venture capitalists often do the same thing. They invest in lots of promising projects knowing that only a few of them will really go on to big success, but that the risk is worth it because it opens up the potential for new kinds of thinking. And to see that same sort of approach take place within government is refreshing.
How has his appointment been received overall? Because, as we know, the CTO role carries great expectations.
I need to caution you a little bit and dial down those expectations slightly. You know, during the campaign, Barack Obama called for this post of the first National Chief Technology Officer and talked about it having a central role in a variety of initiatives, including making government more open, harnessing, the wisdom of the crowd, if you will, in more collaborative forms of government activity of course, looking for efficiencies in how we spend money and how we track the spending of money and so on. It appears now that this is not just going to be the job of the CTO, that in fact, unless things change, that this office of CTO is not going to have as big a footprint in terms of budget authority or staff as was originally envisioned, and instead pieces of that are going to go to the CIO, Vivek Kundra, who has actually got more than just the job of overhauling how governments use computers and procure software and so on, but also all the stuff related to data management and data transparency. These roles that once we thought would all just be in the hands of the CTO, I think are going to be spread out. And it remains to be seen exactly how much Chopra himself, what kind of stamp he'll put on the job. The one thing he brings that I think people in the tech community are definitely excited by is the vision and the ability to explain this vision, that he's a very forceful evangelist for the transformative potential that interactive communications technologies can bring to how we rethink government, and that's a very important role here, that, you know, to carry out President Obama's vision there and fire up the public as well as, 7 million government employees simply by being able to express that well is going to be a major plus. How exactly he knocks heads together and forces agencies to do his bidding when he does not, as of now, have a big staff or a big budget, I think remains to be seen.
So does it feel as though, the aspirations of the Obama administration have been downgraded slightly in terms of what they wanted to do with e-government?
Well, I don't want to throw in the towel on that because I think, I can rattle off a half dozen excellent appointments, high-level special assistant to the president-level appointments. There's a new Office of Social Innovation that's going to be run by a top executive that came from Google, Sonal Shah. There is a open government directive that's being put together by someone in the Office of Science and Technology Policy named Beth Novak, who's well-known for advocacy of Wikifying government. There's in the National Economic Council overseeing all economic planning around and policy around technology and innovation is a dynamo named Susan Crawford, who was on the ICANN board and also, most importantly, to those of us who are netheads, started something called One Web Day, which is a vision of celebrating the web for all the ways that it is, making our society better. There's another person on the new media staff named Katie Stanton, who comes from Google, whose job is to foster more online civic engagement. It's also working out of the White House. So many of the pieces of the president's vision are getting implemented. It's just that it's been spread out into a couple more, different offices and into more hands. And frankly, I think it may have been too much to expect them to create a completely new department. Some people originally thought the CTO might be a cabinet-level position, and certainly there were high hopes that that would be done. And I think what happened during the transition and into the early days of the administration were two things. First, their attention was focused on the economic crisis, on the banking bailout. These are big problems that, a year ago, nobody knew just quite how, serious the challenge would be. And the second thing is that, there is institutional bureaucracy here. There's the kind of, legacy ways of doing things, and it's very hard to create a whole new office with lots of power without ruffling a whole bunch of other feathers. And so what it seems to me they've done is followed a path of less resistance. And I'm still hopeful that we'll see a lot of the more visionary aspects of what Obama talked about in terms of technology and transforming governance take place. But I expect it's going to take a little bit longer.
And what does all of this mean for Middle America? I mean, obviously people like us, people in the tech-related industries and media-related industries are interested in what's going on with these various initiatives. But does it really mean anything much for average Americans?
I think the biggest change, and the one that I'm following closely these days, is how Obama's vision and the choices that he's made in terms of personnel, how this is filtering out across the rest of the federal bureaucracy. There are thousands of government websites in the United States, and until recently, the main priority of government web managers was to control information and cybersecurity, protect these government websites from attacks. And the overall theme of the Bush administration was, thank you, we got your input on Election Day. We're not interested in any more input. We're the deciders. And that went as well for how, you know, government used the web. Now you've got all these government web managers who are really feeling like they have a license to experiment, that they can embrace Web 2.0, and that they can do lots of things to make government sites far more useful to the public and also engage the public in new ways. I'll give you just one example that just came out, literally launched today on the Environmental Protection Agency's website. There's a section called My Environment. And all you do is you type in your address or your zip code or whatever, and up comes a page that is just frankly phenomenal in how it brings together all the data that the EPA has, puts it on a map, and you can see, you know, with a bird's eye view, you can zero in and see, you know, sites near you that, where there have been reports of toxic releases. You can see what the air quality index is for the area near you. You can see what the cancer risk, the mortality records are. What's the water reports like for your state and for your locality, the UV index. It's all there in one place. I've never seen a government website this useful. You know, the old joke about government websites were the best designed ones were the ones were there to collect your taxes. And the worst ones were the ones that in any way were meant to serve you with information or get your input. And that's now, I think, being opened up in a significant way. And I want to give credit to, you know, Obama and his team for, in effect, basically saying, here's a new vision, but now giving all these different agency web managers the mandate to go out and actually make government a lot more useful. And that's so back to middle America. I mean, to find out what, in one click, what the local cancer stats are, what the air quality is, and where the sites of concern may be that are close to you, I mean, that's about as valuable information as you can imagine.
And just finally, Mika Sifri, before I let you go, you mentioned that Anish Chopra, the new Chief Technology Officer, will have to work very closely with the new Chief Information Officer, Vivek Kundra, mm-hmm. who, when we spoke in February, was touted as a possible candidate for the Chief Technology Officer mm-hmm. role. What's the relationship like between those two individuals? Do they know each other well, and how do you think they'll get on?
They do know each other well. They both, in fact, Kundra used to work also in the technology office in Virginia. And so these two men know each other very well. They have very similar philosophies about what Kundra calls the digital public square. And, you know, so it's actually a really good thing. You know, there was some speculation that Obama would pick someone from Silicon Valley, you know, maybe from one of the big telecom firms, Cisco. You know, there were a variety of names that were tossed around. And instead he went with someone in Chopra who already has a lot of experience applying the power of the internet and new technology in the government arena, rather than somebody who comes solely from the business world and would, in effect, have to spend a whole year learning how government works. So I think, you know, this is a very good thing. But ultimately, the proof's going to be in the pudding. They have to now demonstrate that these ideas that everybody's been talking about, they can actually make a difference. At the end of the day, most Americans don't really care how technology is being used. They want to know how it's making their lives better. Is it saving money? Is it making me healthier? Is it going to improve my kids' education or make my community safer? Those are the bottom line questions. And I think that they've got a strong team now to deliver on that. But, you know, we should check in 6 months or a year and see if they've actually done it.
Okay, well, let's do that. Mika Sifri, thank you very much for joining us once again on Future Tense.
Always a pleasure.
And we're coming to you today either through your MP3 player, the net, ABC Radio National, or perhaps Radio Australia. I'm Anthony Fennell. Right, now I want you to leave what you're doing and come join me in here. It won't take long. Now, through the magic of radio, we're sitting together in my new car. Modest to be sure, because I work for the ABC, but new nonetheless. Now, what I want to show you is one of the features which I really love because it concerns our next topic, the Internet of Things. Okay, seatbelt on. we'll just start it up. Now, like many new cars, when I turn over the ignition, the computer in my car does a quick service check, and then it tells me after a few seconds whether anything is wrong. Okay, the computer display has just come up with the words system check okay and a little tick. So, without me doing anything really except turning the key, my car's computer has already done a bit of high-level maintenance. Now, what if there was something wrong? And what if the car's computer could actually diagnose what's amiss and report it to the computer at my local garage? And together, without any human beings being directly involved, the two computers could organise an appointment for me and my car, and even book in a new replacement part from the computer at the local car dealer. Well, one day, not too far into the future, all of that could be a reality. The idea of computers talking to each other without our involvement isn't a new one. But with more and more objects becoming computerised, or at least having internet connectivity, there exists the potential for the internet to enter an entirely new phase. A phase where people and objects are all communicating, sometimes with each other and sometimes with their own kind. Dr. David Skellen is the Chief Executive Officer at NICTA, Australia's Specialist Information and Communication Technology Research Centre. And he says the Internet of Things is already on the way, and there will be benefits.
We're increasingly seeing that objects, you know, everyday things we buy, are now smart. So toys, you know, your mobile phone's extremely smart. A lot of appliances that you buy, you know, white goods and so on, have computers in them. Certain clever lighting systems have computers in them. Many, many things around your house. Lots of your cars, of course, even the low-end cars now have, you know, 10 to 20 computers in them. And all of these computers are able to provide lots of information. And moreover, we're moving into the situation where some of these things can actually be controlled.
What's the benefit, the real benefit, for average consumers?
Well, I think the real benefit is that it gives us contact with those things that are around us. There are many, many health conditions that can be monitored in real time, and can, you know, you can have a device, if you do carry around your mobile phone, could actually keep track of your health. It could tell you how much energy you're using. It you wouldn't need a separate device to tell you how far you've walked. It could tell you how much exercise you're getting each day. It could tell you your vital signs, you know, your heart rate, your blood pressure, and so on. All of these things could be made available to you personally. And I think that would be a very useful outcome for individuals, knowing when you need to service your car rather than kind of guessing that it's every 10,000 kilometres or whatever it might be.
Does it also, though, mean that society is moving to a point where there will be no off switch, if you like, that, you know, everything will be on?
Yeah, everything will be on. That's exactly right. The issue of whether you want to do anything with it, whether you want to be part of that environment is up to you. I mean, you can choose to, you know, opt out of that and not be connected and not have things monitoring you. And we have to make the internet so that that's the case, so that you're in charge of the situation as opposed to the government being in charge of it.
So if almost every manufactured item in the future will in some way be connected to the internet or be computerised, what are the implications for energy consumption? Won't a world where everything is on simply chew up more of our energy resources? David Skellen again.
This is a really interesting question because it's certainly the case that information and communications technology devices are chewing up more and more energy. And there's a huge effort in the community, in the computer and electronics community, to reduce that amount of energy, to look for lower and more efficient devices. But inevitably, as we have more and more systems connected, we are going to see an increase in the amount of energy that's used. At present, we're looking at moving to 4% over the next 10 years or so of the world's energy will be used in ICT. And I'm not quoting that figure exactly, it's that sort of order of magnitude. Now, the areas that we've been looking at, not just us, but many, many research groups around the world looking at, is how do you use these devices to, yes, they do consume energy, but how can they save energy? And if you look at the payback there, it is really huge. So, for example, a simple example is automatic devices that control lighting and determine when you need to have, and we've seen these already, right? They're around, many of them are already around the place, but we can do much better to know when to turn lights on, when to turn them off, and simple things like that can save a lot of energy. There are much more sophisticated ways you can save energy. So if we take this car example, it turns out that if we could better control the way the engine management system in the car, if we knew more about the surroundings, if we knew, for example, when a light was going to turn on or off, you know, a traffic light, and we let the computer in the car determine that we're actually going to be in a braking mode, then it could change the whole energy system in the car to save energy. And the savings are not trivial. General Motors has recently, we've been talking with a number of companies about this, but General Motors has estimated that you might save 15 to 20%, well, something of that order of magnitude, in the braking situation by being able to alter the energy of the car and the energy usage in the car during a braking circumstance. So there are lots of ways that you could use the fact that you know what's going on around you because the devices are connected to the internet and communicating that information. Lots of ways you could imagine saving energy.
Of course, in Australia in recent times, the big issue, or one of the big issues, has been the state of our broadband network. What impact could the Internet of Things have on our existing internet infrastructure, and what sort of preparations do we need to start making to lay the groundwork for it?
Well, the internet infrastructure is kind of the fundamental underpinning of this. You have to have an infrastructure that can carry all this information. And I'm very pleased that we're going to soon be seeing an improved infrastructure. It is fascinating that, in fact, the Internet of Things can enable more efficient and use monitoring, maintenance and development of the broadband infrastructure itself. And so there are a lot of measuring devices that can be placed in that infrastructure. One of the companies that spun out of NICTA is, in fact, exactly in that space. It's a company called Monitoring Division, and it uses a clever optical technique combined with some machine learning techniques to be able to measure the impairments on the very high-speed optical fibre cables that are at the core of the internet. At the present time, operators who have these very high-speed cables really don't know to the level of detail they need how their cables are performing and therefore how much information they can send over them at which times. And this technology that we've developed and that Monitoring Division is taking to market is one that enables us to do that. So that, in fact, turns out to be a clever measuring device, monitoring device, that is placed at strategic points around the internet, around the underlying broadband infrastructure, and that information is fed back to the operator so they know how to best deploy and best send the information over the net.
Interest is quite high. The Internet of Things has gotten significant attention around the globe, both from industry and governments. But having been in the communications and internet industry for about 12 years now, whenever I hear the phrase, the next big thing, I always take that with a grain of salt, if you will. You know, there's no doubt that we're moving and evolving toward object identification, that we're seeing implementations of track and trace in particular industries, but we're still very much in the early stages of adoption.
That's Brian Cute. He's the Vice President of Discovery Services for the internet infrastructure company Afilias. And Mr. Cute will be a keynote speaker at a major conference on the concept of the Internet of Things, which gets underway in Brussels in a week's time. The gathering is being organised by the European Commission.
The European Union has definitely taken a forward-leaning position and a lead position in trying to understand what the implications of the Internet of Things are going to be for consumers, for businesses, for the market. They have been very active in developing forward-looking policy frameworks, because when the Internet of Things does become a reality, you do have active sensors in many environments and data collection where you didn't before. issues such as privacy, issues such as security, even network architecture issues are going to become very important, and governments have a unique interest in making sure that those issues are addressed.
Now, I know privacy is one of the themes that that will be discussed at this upcoming European conference. In a world where objects are increasingly connected, do those issues of privacy become more important, do you think? I mean, is that going to be an area where this whole concept is going to meet a bit of a wall, if you like, a bit of resistance?
You know, I think it's easy to say yes, that when you conceive or picture this, you know, sensor-based world, that privacy suddenly becomes a paramount concern for the individual. But at the same time, the Internet of Things, it's going to evolve in stages. We're not going to wake up tomorrow and be surrounded by sensors. And the other thing that I think is going to change, particularly if you look at the youth segment and how younger folks and the younger generation are using technology. Look at things like Twitter. Look at how young folks are exposing themselves, you know, where they are, what they're doing. We can say, you know, in a vacuum that, well, that's a privacy issue, and maybe it is, but what I'm suggesting is that the next generation coming up, the way they interact with technology, their behaviors, their expectations of privacy will not be the same that we have. So there's going to be a bit of an evolution, both in the technology and in attitudes. And I think that governments, or I hope that governments, will be sensible enough to have a flexible approach to issues such as privacy.
And so I presume you would say that there will have to be an evolution as well in terms of telecommunications regulations.
No doubt, no doubt. And that's another interesting area. The Internet, to a large degree, has become a global facility, an open, remarkable technology that's really transformed the communications landscape because of some key policy decisions that were made at the beginning of the Internet that facilitated that growth. So in the same way, governments have to be very thoughtful about the policies that they adopt vis-a-vis this Internet of Things to ensure that they're continuing to foster a growth, innovation, jobs, all the things that are very important to every country.
Now, we've talked about the approach of government and also research, but how much interest is there from commercial companies in this concept?
Quite a bit. You know, if you look at virtually all of the largest IT companies, all of the largest communications companies have had significant focus, significant investment, pursuing technology implementations, pilots. There's very, very, very strong interest. The question, of course, always in the marketplace is the market ready? What's going to be the first implementation that's going to really get traction? Again, I think this is going to evolve, though. I mean, it'll come in stages. You'll see it in the supermarket. There'll be tagged shelves and tagged products, and soon enough, you know, someone with their mobile phone, you can go in and you can see the potatoes or the cake mix and swipe the tag on the shelf and have, you know, coupons and recipe information pushed to your phone. And I think once we get through that next stage, then the consumer being comfortable with that sort of interaction, the notion of having RFID in your fridge at home doesn't become such a cold, distant, threatening type of scenario. So I think as a matter of stages, consumer attitudes will evolve.
Brian Cute from the Internet Infrastructure Services Company, Afilias. And that's the show for another week. Now, as I've said before, this is not a program that highlights new technology for its own sake. But sometimes we can't help ourselves. So next on Future Tense, it's a case of boys' toys, as I go 60 metres underground to check out a state-of-the-art tunnelling machine. And girls' toys, when we speak with Dr. Christine Charles, who's developing a revolutionary engine for space travel. So join us again next time. Thanks to producer Andrew Davies and technical producer Jim Usher. I'm Anthony Fennell, and this is ABC Radio National.
I got up, I turned on their hi-fi system, and this amazing music came out from the radio.
What is radio? In the age of endless connections, what's special about listening to the wireless as a broadcast?
Sound is a ghost, in a way. And radio in this previous era was like a kind of haunting.
The present tense of radio is what makes our experience of listening so immediate and sometimes so powerful. What happens when technology frees us from the tyranny of appointment listening?
I burst into tears. I couldn't stand. I just lay down flat on the carpet.
Listening to Ghosts, the 360 feature. And, ironically, you can download this program from the Radio National website.